Hi, I'm Ed Slott.
And I'm Jeff Levine.
And we're two guys who just love to talk about retirement and taxes.
Look, our mission is simple, to educate you, the saver, so that you can make better decisions, because better decisions, on the whole, lead to better outcomes.
And here's how we're going to do that. Each week, Jeff and I will debate the pros and the cons of a particular retirement strategy or topic, with the goal of helping you keep more of your hard-earned money.
At the end of each debate, there's going to be one clear winner. You, a more informed saver who can hopefully apply the merits of each side of the debate to your own personal situation to decide what's best for you and your family.
So here we go. Welcome to the Great Retirement Debate. Welcome, everybody, to the latest edition, a special edition of the Great Retirement Debate with Jeff Levine. I'm Ed Slott, and I'm going to turn it over to Jeff Levine to tell us why this is such a special edition that you'll want to replay probably several times.
Well, Ed, we're talking here about the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, or I believe you told me before we were getting on here, you're starting to think of it as ABBA, right? You're hearing people talk about it as ABBA?
Yeah, and they have a song called Money, Money, Money.
Yeah, all right. Well, hopefully people take a chance and listen to our episode here. So with that said, right, let's think about what we're going to do. Because this is such a big deal, right, it is the One Big Beautiful Bill, we're actually going to have five separate questions. Normally, we just have one question we discuss for our full episode, but we're going to break it down into five different questions, all about the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that was recently enacted into law, that is currently law as we sit here today. And Ed, we're going to start with, you know, the big picture, and it's what to you is the most impactful thing that we can take away from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act? What do you think is the most impactful provision or set of provisions?
Well, staying away, which we will, from all the health care provisions and things like that, mainly the tax provisions, I think the idea that, as the way I see it, virtually anyone who pays tax will pretty much pay less tax. There's a little something in here for everyone from top to bottom and in between. So I think it's a pretty widespread bill, from estate tax to no tax. Well, I don't want to call it no tax on tips, but the tip deduction and overtime deduction and things like that. So it's pretty well rounded.
Yeah, you know, for me, I think the biggest impact is the fact that for a lot of people, there was no real big impact, right? There's all this talk about massive tax cuts or a massive tax increase. It was all relative to if the Tax Cut and Jobs Act expired. And ultimately, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act did not expire. Now, as you said, there is a little bit of something for everybody in this bill, if you will. But a lot of what is being talked about is relative to if we went back to a pre-TCJA world. So when people think, like, what's the impact versus my 2025 return to my 2026 return? For a lot of people, it's not going to be this huge difference that maybe they're contemplating, because they're thinking about all these tax cuts. Because again, it's large. The biggest thing is it's an extension of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act permanently. You know, the tax brackets, those are going to be continued in permanence, right? The 10, the 12, the 22, the 24, the 32, the 35, the 37% top rate, those are our continued tax brackets. The roughly doubling of the standard deduction, that stays in place. Now, it's a little bit different. There's some, you know, some fine tuning around the edges, but those are sort of the big things. Things like AMT for a lot of taxpayers, right? That is still going to be a non-issue for most, more than it was maybe in 2025, but for most people, still a non-issue. So for me, the big impact is sort of business as usual for most individuals.
You used the word there. You used the word I want you to define. And I looked it up on artificial intelligence, AI. You used a word called permanent. And it's permanent means lasting or intended to last or remain unchanged indefinitely. What do you think of that? The things that are called permanent in the tax code.
That's a really good point, and I'm glad you brought that up. So that is the definition, right? Is intended to last. And I think that's a good word in that definition. It's intended to last indefinitely. Those who just passed this law, intend it to last indefinitely. But of course, as we know, we've got a two-party system in this country. I don't know, maybe a third if Elon gets his way at some point. But we have a multi-party system here, meaning not everybody agrees on everything. And certainly there are different views on tax policy. So permanent, from a tax planning parlance, simply means it's the rule until a future Congress changes the rule, which a future Congress can do at any time and sort of override the previous Congress. So, Ed, I've heard you speak over the years and effectively say that, the tax code is not written in ink, it's written in pencil.
Right.
I often say it's not chiseled in stone, but they're all flavors of the same thing. In other words, permanent is this is the rule until someone else says otherwise. And that's different from something that has what's called a sunset in the law, where it's sort of a scheduled termination date of that rule. And for the most part, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act provisions were permanently extended. Some of the new things that are introduced by the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the no tax on tips, the no tax on
Oh.
overtime, the extended deduction for seniors, et cetera. These are all things that have a temporary or a sunset associated with them. So those are not permanent, but most, again, of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, the rules that we have today, those are largely extended permanently. It's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, the reason I say it is even for the ones that are permanent, the planning you should do is get it while it's here now. Like
That's
in
right.
Roth conversions, if your tax rates are low, don't think you have all these years out. Get it while these tax reductions, especially the reduced rates that are going to be extended, are here.
So, like, order while supplies last is what you're saying.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's a
Yeah.
good one, right?
Yeah. All right. So, number two on our list, Ed, what was the most surprising thing to you in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act? We had different versions. We had, a House version, then a Senate version, then another Senate version that went back to the House and ultimately passed. But in the final version of this bill, what was ultimately enacted into law, what is the most surprising thing to you?
Well, the surprising, I think, game changer for those in high tax states was the acceleration, the bump up on the SALT, state and local tax deduction, from 10,000 to 40,000 for most taxpayers, since most there is a limit, a $500,000 income limit, and phases out after that, but most people are under that. And that could be a big game changer. You may see a lot more people in the high tax states switching over from standard deduction to itemized deductions, which would open up the itemized deductions. Not only in other words, the large amount, the 40,000, gets you into the arena. Then you can pile on your charitable mortgage interest and everything else. So that would change. I was surprised they did that because that was a big debate right up till the last minute.
Yeah, that was probably one of the most hotly contested things. And, I think for me, one of the most surprising elements of it was that they actually left alone those so-called pass-through entity taxes, the sort of workaround.
Oh,
Both the
yeah.
House bill,
For
it was
me
really
too.
interesting. The House bill said we want to eliminate it or at least reduce its impact, and they had one way. And the Senate had said we want to reduce it and or eliminate its impact, and they had another way. And then when they compromised, there was no impact whatsoever. So these are those workarounds for like small business owners, a sole
Yes.
proprietorship, a partnership, a S corporation, where you can effectively pay your state and local taxes through your business and then get a sort of personal income tax benefit of some kind, whether it's an income exclusion or a credit.
Right.
The rules vary from state to state, but they left that alone. The other thing I thought that was really surprising in that SALT arena was, I had before the final bill was passed, maybe a month or two ago, I put out a question on both Twitter or X, as it's called now, and LinkedIn, saying, what do you think the final SALT
Oh,
provisions will look like? Just as a kind of,
yeah.
let's see where we all stand. And my thought was that we'd have a $40,000 limit for single filers. That was correct,
Right. That's a big.
but I also thought we'd have an $80,000 limit, maybe
No.
double that for joint filers. An elimination of the so-called marriage penalty, because that's
Right.
been a real sticking point for folks. In other words, one person, or excuse me, two people, while they're separate, can have much higher SALT deductions than they can once they're married. And not only did they not get rid of the marriage penalty in the final bill, they actually made it worse in a lot
Right.
of ways, because the final One Big Beautiful Bill Act has a $40,000 cap until you get to $500,000 of income. And that applies for everyone except married filing separate individuals, right? Like it's half of that for those individuals. But that means a married couple and a single couple both have the same $40,000 maximum deduction on their personal tax returns. And they both begin to phase out that maximum $40,000 amount at the same $500,000 of income. And married couples tend to have more income because there's two people. So they're going to phase out the same lower total faster, which to me was a surprise.
So if you have a married couple, two high tax taxpayer, high income taxpayers, as a married couple, are you saying they should divorce over this?
That's beyond. I'm not a divorce attorney yet. I wouldn't want to provide legal
Well, there's
advice on
money
this
in it.
call. You know what I would say though is this: it does raise an interesting discussion, right, Ed? At what point, if I told you you've got to work to make another $100,000, at what point would it no longer pay to earn that extra $100,000 if you had to give X amount back in the form of taxes?
You know, it's funny you say that. Isn't that what Ronald Reagan said when he stopped making movies?
You probably know better than me. That's
Yes.
before my
He
time.
said, I'm not making any. Well, back then the top rate was 90%. He says, I'm losing money on this. And he stopped making movies once he hit a certain amount because it just wasn't
Yeah.
working.
Yeah, right. And I mean, even if you get something, like your time is valuable. And you know, the reason I bring that up is that jump from $500,000 of income to $600,000 of income, where that $40,000 SALT deduction can get phased out to 10,000, that creates a really large spike in
That's
marginal
right.
rates. If we
On that
ignore
30,000.
everything, what's that?
On that 30,000.
That well, right, well, it's on the $100,000 of
Right.
additional income, you're losing
Right.
$30,000 of deductions. So
Right.
effectively, for every $1 you make, you're paying tax on $1.30, which once you're in the 30% rate, we're talking about nearly a 45% federal marginal tax rate. And that's ignoring anything else that you may be phased in or phased out of, and ignoring any state income tax impacts. So you might easily be north of 50 or even 55% of that additional $100,000 of income, leaving your hands in the form of taxes, which I think is a pretty big deal too.
Yeah, there's a lot of planning in that one provision.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Ed, question number three here on our One Big Beautiful Bill Act special episode. What's the biggest misconception to you that arises from this bill? What's the biggest misconception? What's the thing that you've heard people say, or maybe have seen even an article somewhere that's not quite what is actually in the final bill?
Yeah, well, this whole business of below the line and above the line. And what I mean is things that reduce adjusted gross income, a deduction to get to a key number on the tax return. Adjusted gross income determines your tax on net investment income, Medicare surcharges, all of those things, versus deductions that don't reduce AGI, adjusted gross income, but just taxable income. And the big one, I think the big misconception is that $6,000, which is a great provision, extra de senior deduction for those 65 or over. So a lot of it, if you go online and things, it's marketed on as no tax on Social Security. That's absolutely not the case. Your adjusted gross income is what it is. Whatever the taxable amount of your Social Security benefits are on the return is still the taxable amount. Now, when you get down and take the $6,000 deduction, if you qualify, there are income limits, it reduces the tax on all income, even if you don't get Social Security income. In fact, because it's 65 or over, those who claim Social Security early before that, they still get that deduction, even though they're below age. Well, no, they don't get
You
that
mean
deduction.
they don't get
Yeah.
the deduction, right? They'd have the same tax on their
Let's
Social
do that one
Security.
again. Even those who claim
So
Social
everything you just said, but the exact opposite, is that
right.
right?
Yeah. All
Okay.
right. Let's start again. Even those who collect Social Security earlier, say at 62 or 63 or something, they don't get this deduction. So how could it be a deduction because they're not 65? How could it be a deduction that's targeted to saying your Social Security is not taxable? In fact, you get the deduction if you qualify for the deduction. It does not reduce your IRMA charges, those Medicare charges for Parts B and T, B and D, because that's locked in based on your adjusted or modified adjusted gross income.
So really the misconception you're saying is that, well, the
You tell
net
me what I
result
meant
here
to
is that
say.
most people won't pay tax on their Social Security,
Right.
but it's not necessarily because there is no tax on Social Security. It's because there are some other deductions in there that in the end make taxable income, make it more likely that you're not going to pay income tax, period, right? I mean, I think it's fair to say that before the OBBA, before this One Big Beautiful Bill Act, most people still didn't pay tax on their Social Security because they didn't have enough income in
That's
retirement
true.
to pay tax on Social Security. So for them, there's really no impact. But for those who had a little bit more income, but not too much, they now have a tax-free. I think the statistics I've seen largely, Ed, say that we go from about, two-thirds of people maybe not paying income tax
That's
on
what
their
I saw. I
Social
saw.
Security before, to about maybe three-quarters or 80% of folks. So more people won't pay tax on their Social Security, but it's not everyone, and it's not, again, because it's directly at Social Security. And Ed, I'm actually going to follow along with what you have there. There are two provisions in the bill that, to me, when we talk about biggest misconceptions, and you already
Right.
mentioned them, I think I did too earlier, the no tax on tips and the no tax on overtime provisions. Those are the names of the provisions in the bill, right? And you and I, we try to walk the fine line, Ed, especially on these things. When a tax law is passed, it's always a politically divisive issue. Some people look at the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and they do think it's big and beautiful, and others look at it and they say it's big, but maybe not so beautiful. That's a personal choice, right? And I can understand people on either side of that situation. But when it comes to, the black and white, the provisions of the bill, if you look at the actual bill text, it says no tax on tips, no tax on overtime. I think those
Right.
are two big misconceptions. A
Yes.
more appropriate way to have framed that is no income tax on some tips and no income tax on some overtime. And the reason I make that distinction is, for one, there are income limits to both of those provisions. So if you make enough money, you're not going to get any benefit. All your tips and all your overtime are still going to be taxable to you in the same way they were before the bill. Now, admittedly, a lot of people who have tips, they work in a job where they're maybe a waiter or a waitress or some other profession where they're not going to be making hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars a year and phased out. So let's go to the second part of that. Let's say you actually benefit from this provision. The no tax on tips or the no tax on overtime eliminate the income tax on those
Right.
amounts, but they don't impact FICA, right? Or employment taxes, things like
Yeah.
your Social Security and Medicare taxes, or your self-employment taxes if you're self-employed. So again, it's not a, I'm not saying these provisions are good or bad. I'm simply saying the letter of the law, where it literally says as a header to these sections, no tax on tips and no tax on overtime, are a little bit are not quite accurate in and of themselves, right? A
Right.
more accurate title would have been no income tax on some tips, no income tax on some overtime. But of course, that doesn't roll off the tongue quite as easily as no tax on tips or overtime.
Or
So that's my biggest misconception.
something as simple as a deduction for tips income or deduction for overtime.
Yep, yes, that would have been, I think, a more accurate way to maybe have phrased that. Yep. But of course, in the 11th hour when you're writing this bill, you get what you can in there, and the
Yeah.
provisions, the titling ultimately is irrelevant, other than when it comes to perhaps, like we're saying, people being confused by what is actually in there. All right, Ed, let's go on to our fourth topic here. And for years, you've been known as the guy to go to when it comes to IRAs. And while we don't really have any direct changes to IRAs, we do have a new sort of account, the Trump account, built on the IRA chassis, so to speak, right? It effectively, Trump accounts are going to be IRA accounts that have some special provisions in there, and they'll be called Trump accounts. That is the name for them once again under the bill. So, Ed, just real quick, what are your thoughts? What are your high-level thoughts on Trump accounts?
Well, everybody's going to want them because the big incentive is they're going to be seeded with free money for qualifying children born at a certain time at a certain age. So you better, if you're new parents, work around the bill. It's all about
That's
tax
right.
planning. And everybody gets $1,000, so to seed the account once. And then even in the bill, as you said, if you look at
That's for kids born from 2025 this year through 2028.
I'm checking because there's so many different. So yeah,
Just say right. It's right.
25 to 28. Yeah, I have to look it up myself. And that's another thing with this bill. You've got to check the effective dates. Like we talked about, some are permanent until Congress says otherwise, but let's call them permanent. Some are like here, the senior deduction we talked about, only for 25 to 28. The Trump thing is the $1,000, 25 to 28, the
The
tips.
accounts themselves are permanent, but that
Yeah, right.
little government seeding of here's $1,000 because you had a baby,
Yeah,
right? A baby gift
right.
from the Uncle Sam.
So there's a lot of talk about it. And as you said, if you look in the law, it says Trump accounts will be defined as individual retirement accounts, but they go one step further and say, but not Roth accounts. They make it very
Yeah.
clear. Not Roth, individual retirement. So once the child turns 18, they will function as IRAs. So I think it's a tremendous, there's a big advantage. First of all, it incentivizes people, parents, incentivizes a 5-year-old to finally get a job instead of watching TV all day. But you don't need a job. Unlike an IRA, these funds, let's say you put in $5,000, a grandparent or a parent puts that in. They can put that in for a child, even though they have no wages or self-employment income, qualifying
No
income,
compensation, right, to support an
compensation.
IRA contribution.
Yeah, which you would need to do an IRA. This is, I think, a big sleeper, a big benefit in the bill because for right up to 18, that's a lot of money that can be put in, plus employers can put in. So there's a lot of ways that this money can be put in there. It goes in, obviously, non-deductible. If the employer puts it in, it is taxable because you got that for free. Same thing with the 1,000. But at 18, it becomes an IRA. It could be, and I think, I'm not sure about this. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe once they turn into IRAs, or maybe even before, they can be converted to Roth IRAs for the children.
Yeah, I think that's one of the areas of the bill, Ed, that we're going to need some IRS regulations to really flesh out. One of the interesting things was that they said was no, that the pro rata rule for IRAs won't coordinate with the pro rata rule for Trump accounts. So
Right.
I don't know. Like I honestly, I don't know the answer to that question. I think I don't have a firm opinion on that. Well, it's one of the questions I have that I hope the IRS will answer at some point. If you could indeed do that, I think that would lend a lot more credence to maybe funding these Trump accounts earlier in life. If you can't, for me, they may end up as not that big of a deal because you can put $5,000 into those accounts per year, which is nice, but you could also put $5,000 into, let's say, an UTMA or an UGMA account. And I know UTMA and UGMA accounts don't have much in the way of tax benefits, right? Like there really is none for those accounts. They're taxable to the child, and usually the child is subject to kiddie tax on anything north of about $2,000 or $2,500 or so. So there may be some consideration there, but if you look at the text of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, one of the things it requires is basically you've got to invest those dollars in a
Right.
mutual fund or an ETF that tracks a U.S. Stock index. And if it's going to track a U.S. stock index, it's probably not going to have a lot in the way of dividends and whatnot. And if you just hold it, like think of something very simple, like I'm going to buy an S&P 500 index fund and hold on to it for 18 years until the kid reaches age 18. There's not a lot of tax drag. In other words, you're not paying a lot of income tax. The value of the IRA wrapper, if you will, is minimal if you're just holding an index fund and you're taking the future income and you're taking it from what could be capital gain income and you're turning it into ordinary income if it comes out of one of these Trump accounts. So I'm not sure how much value it will actually add to folks. Now, once the kid is 18, if they now become like a day trader, right, and they're buying and selling and wheeling and dealing, then that tax deferral might be really, really valuable to them from 18 through, their retirement or the end of their life. But if that child is actually going to use the money somewhat earlier for things like college or buying a home, I'm not sure how much ultimate value will be provided from these accounts. And I think it's worth noting that unlike the earlier provisions of the accounts back when they were first known or referred to as even like MAGA accounts, there's no tax incentive really, other than the IRA wrapper. Initially, there was talks about having certain income come out at capital gain rates and so forth.
Oh no, that
None of
never
that
came back.
really applies here. It's just going to be like an IRA. So it's going to be ordinary income when it comes out. So that to me really took what could have been a much more valuable provision for young folks and really diluted it. Again, especially with the requirement to go into what are generally pretty tax efficient investments in and of themselves.
Right, but all of that said, I don't think anybody's going to walk away from a $3,000 seed.
No, I'm not planning on any more kids here, Ed, but I promise you that if for whatever reason there one comes between now and 2025 and 2028, I will make sure to open up my account because I will take whatever free $1,000 I can get
Right,
for
that's
sure.
the point. And I think,
Yep.
again, back to the Roth thing, let's say it's available at, say, age 18, which sounds like it could be because it's supposed to function as an IRA. That would be unbelievable for these kids because chances are they're still in very low rates. They could convert it all to Roth. This could be an amazing thing.
Yeah, I think for a lot of those kids, like the timing would be wait until you're just out of college or for whatever reason no longer a subject to the kiddie tax, and
Right.
then make that conversion then. Absolutely. All right, Ed, that brings us to our final question here for today, which is maybe the most important question of all of our five questions here. Based on the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, and I realize, it's very hard to say what any one person should do or everybody should do because there's so much in the bill and it's different for each person. But what are some of the actions that people should think about taking today in light of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act?
You know what I'm going to say. Put the pedal to the metal on Roth conversions. Take advantage of these low rates. You also have, we didn't mention it much, the extension of the 20% qualified business income deduction.
Sure.
That's not something you have to say, take advantage, do something, you just have to earn for that. But that's a great provision. And it could work in tandem with the Roth conversion planning because of income levels. But Roth conversions are here for a while, hopefully. You know, if these tax cuts are permanent for some period of time, whatever that is, people were saying at the end of 25, you got a me too, doing all your conversions before the rates go up, but now they're extended. I wouldn't stop that train from going because you still can take advantage. Every year you take advantage of low brackets, or put it the other way, every year you don't take advantage of low brackets, you blew your tax planning. So if there's one big item for retirees, start moving money to Roth IRAs while the rates are low.
Yeah, I think about some of the other things that have like definitive timelines on this. That's a good point, and that's like great long-term advice for folks because that's going to be the rule no matter how long it lasts. But as you've said, how long will it last? We don't know. But for me, it's maybe things like if you're looking at buying an electric vehicle, you've got only a really
All
limited period
right.
of time in which to do that or to update your house, right? Those credits are supposed to be wiped out or eliminated under this bill at much faster periods than it was going to be before. So, for instance, buying a car, you may want to do that maybe before the end of September. If you're doing home improvements, you may want to have those completed before the end of the year, accelerating timelines on some other actions. If you were thinking about making charitable contributions, and you make deductions or you take an itemized deduction on your tax return, there may be some incentives to giving sooner rather than later because beginning next year, individuals who itemize will have to exceed one half, that's 0.5% of their AGI, in order to claim a charitable deduction on their tax return, whereas this year that doesn't exist. If you don't itemize, though, you may want to wait until next year to make your charitable contributions, because this year there is no deduction available for charitable contributions to non-itemizers. But beginning next year, on a quote-unquote permanent basis, individuals who are married and file a joint return can take up to $2,000 of
Right.
deductions for charitable contributions made in cash, even if they don't itemize, and single filers can do half of that. So there are a lot of these little intricacies here based on the fine-tuning and the timing of this bill. But I think for me, Ed, the biggest action that people should take is reach out to a qualified professional if you
Right.
haven't already and understand what this looks like for you. Everyone's situation is different. It is so hard. You know, every once in a while someone says, like, what does this mean for me? It's like, well, even just for you, you could look at one provision of the law and say, this isn't good. But what about all the other 17,000
Right.
provisions that also impact you? You've got to look at that. And, you know, Ed, I know even for someone like you or myself, it's very difficult to even eyeball a potential impact to someone when there are so many. It's like a pinball machine, right? There's so many
Yeah.
different things that can happen on the tax return that you really want to make sure you're getting proper advice. There may be things that you should be doing now. There may be things that you shouldn't be doing now. So for me, the biggest action you should take is get personalized guidance as to what this means for you and whether or not there are actions you should or should not be taking in the near and long term so that you can put yourself and your family in the best possible position.
I think that's true. And back to our original point, I think what you just said applies to every taxpayer. There's something in here, I believe, that affects every single taxpayer.
I agree. It is you know, again, we said there's some discussion and there's room for disagreement as to how good or bad the bill is, but it is definitively a big bill, a big piece of legislation. There's no doubt about that. So it could mean big changes for you, which brings us to the end of our debate for today, Ed. And actually, before we wrap up, I think it's worth pointing out that you know, this law is still new, and there are a possibility that some things that we think today may ultimately change over time. There's always some surprises in future IRS regulations and announcements and so forth. So we'll stay tuned for that. And of course, as we go on, you know, this is a pretty significant bill. It's probably not the last you'll hear from Ed and I on it. There's lots of individual provisions in here that we might dive deeper into in a future episode of the Great Retirement Debate. But ultimately, Ed, our Great Retirement Debate, the purpose of all of our debates is to create one winner, and it's not Ed, and it's not me. It's you, the listener, who has more information and can make a more educated decision. Ed and I firmly believe that the more education and information an individual has, the better decisions that they will make. And on the whole, better decisions lead to better outcomes. And that is our hope for you. So thanks for joining us for this special episode of the Great Retirement Debate covering the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Ed, you had not one, but many big, beautiful answers. We appreciate it. And thank you for listening. We'll see you all real soon.
Jeffrey Levine is Chief Planning Officer at Focus Partners. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be construed as specific investment, accounting, legal, or tax advice. Certain information mentioned may be based on third-party information which may become outdated or otherwise superseded without notice. Third-party information is deemed to be reliable, but its accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. The topic discussed and corresponding arguments are those of the speakers and may not accurately reflect those of Focus Partners.